The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Thank you. Well, it's my pleasure to be the moderator tonight. Thanks very much for coming. This is a very important issue, very recently argued, as you probably know, before the Supreme Court. So a very timely panel put on by our law school's criminal law brief and the Criminal Law Society. And we have a stellar lineup of speakers. Thanks very much for coming on this Thursday, rainy Thursday night. Really appreciate it. Jody Kent and Vincent Sutherland in the middle will be arguing that imprisoning juveniles for life for non-homicide offenses should be deemed cruel and unusual punishment. They'll also share their perspectives from a rich background of advocacy in the courts and before Congress and about reducing harsh punishment for juveniles. And then on the outside, we have it's our pleasure to have Scott Burns and Cully Stimson. They'll be speaking about the state's interest in leaving space for a diversity of democratically decided approaches to punishment, including life imprisonment for non-homicide offenses. And they'll share perspectives from a rich background of practice in the trenches and the front lines of criminal law issues. They have such distinguished biographies. I'm going to try to abbreviate, but I will introduce each individually. Jody Kent is a national coordinator at the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, and the organization supports and assists advocates in several states where legislation to eliminate life without parole for youth is active or planned. Ms. Kent also works to provide support for federal legislation introduced by Judiciary Committee Chairman John Conyers and Representative Bobby Scott, to eliminate life without parole sentences for all youth in the United States. She was previously also a policy analyst at the National Prison Project of the ACLU. Vincent Sutherland, who we're also very proud to have, joined the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in August 2008. Mr. Sutherland is an assistant counsel in LDS Criminal Justice Project, representing prisoners sentenced to death in post-conviction proceedings and engaging in advocacy around other criminal justice policy issues. Before joining LDF, Mr. Sutherland was a staff attorney at the Bronx Defenders, where he represented indigent defendants accused of crimes in the Bronx Criminal Court. He previously served as an E. Barrett Prettyman Fellow in Georgetown University Law Center's Criminal Justice Clinic, and we're very happy to have him here. Thank you for coming. So for the states and for the government, we have Mr. Burns, Scott Burns. He's the executive director at the National District Attorneys Association, which consists of the American Prosecutors Research Institute, the National College of District Attorneys, and the NAC, the National Advocacy Center. And before becoming executive director of the NDAA, in March 2009, Mr. Burns spent 15 years as the DA, District Attorney, in Iron County, Utah, and 7 years as Deputy Director at the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Thanks very much for coming tonight. And finally, last but not at all least, we have Charles Cully Stimson. He's a leading expert in criminal law, military commissions, and detention policy at the Heritage Foundation Center for Legal Justice Studies. Mr. Stimson previously served as a Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary for Detainee Affairs, where he advised the Secretary of Defense on detainee issues worldwide, including about issues at Guantanamo Bay, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And in this capacity, he coordinated the department's detention policy and operations with his senior counterparts at the National Security Council, Justice and State Departments, and members of the military and intelligence communities. He also chaired the Pentagon's Joint Detainee Coordinating Committee and co-chaired the Defense Senior Leadership's Oversight Committee, which was responsible for tracking and executing all 492 recommendations from the 12 major investigations into the Defense Department's detention policy and practices in the aftermath of the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. So I'm sure you'll have many questions for Mr. Stimson tonight. So thanks very much for coming. Lovely to have you. In terms of the order of business,
Jody, if Jody could give her perspective.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be part of this distinguished panel. As mentioned, I'm the national coordinator of the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, which is a group of lawyers, mental health experts, law enforcement officers, doctors, teachers, crime victims, family members, and young people, all dedicated to ending the practice of sentencing youth to die in prison. And as one of the only people in this room who is not an attorney or an attorney-to-be, I'm particularly delighted to be here to weigh in on the policy perspective of sentencing youth to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And I've been told I have to refrain from all of my lawyer jokes until later, so I'll spare you. In short, sentencing youth to life without the possibility of parole is bad public policy. This evening I'll discuss some of the major problems with the law or with the practice, including the fact that it's used arbitrarily and unfairly, and therefore it doesn't appear to be making our communities much safer. It contradicts scientific research about youth development, and it contradicts, importantly, American values. Last week's Supreme Court cases shed light on some of the problematic aspects of sentencing youth to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The two cases before the court, Sullivan v. Florida and Graham v. Florida, raised important questions about the constitutionality of sentencing youth to life in prison without the possibility of parole for non-homicide offenses. There are 109 people serving juvenile life without parole for non-homicide offenses in the United States. 76 of those, or 70%, are in Florida. However, just next door in Georgia, there's not a single individual serving the sentence for a similar offense, which raises questions about whether this is actually a public safety issue. In fact, Florida and four other states imprison two-thirds of all of the individuals serving life in prison without the possibility of parole for crimes committed under the age of 18. And we are in a classroom, so this is going to be a quiz. Can you tell me the other four states that imprison the two-thirds of the people serving?
Alabama.
Nope.
Michigan.
Texas.
Michigan.
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania.
Utah.
Alrighty with the Utah jokes.
Wait, so who said Texas? Okay, so for once, we actually can give Texas credit for doing something really well, because they actually, in September, enacted a law that eliminates the practice of sentencing juveniles as defined by the state statute to life in prison without the possibility of parole. So let's give Texas a round of applause. So we've got two out of the four.
California.
Got one in the deep south.
Mississippi.
She got it again.
Did you say Louisiana?
No.
Yes, that was what I was about to say, Louisiana, so you pointed it.
Louisiana. So again, this does raise some questions about why it is that there is a concentration of these people serving the sentence in these five states and not throughout the nation. And again, 11 other states in Washington, D.C. either prohibit or do not use the sentence. So are we to assume that kids in Michigan are far more dangerous than those in New York? There are no people serving the sentence in New York. Or are we to assume that youth in Florida are far more dangerous than those just miles north in Georgia? So these are some of the questions we have to ask ourselves as we look at this practice and think about whether it is sound policy. Joe Sullivan and Terrence Graham are two of more than 2,500 people serving life in prison without the possibility of parole for crimes committed under the age of 18. They are the only ones in the world serving this sentence. The U.S. is alone in this practice. So I'd like to tell you a story about one of the people serving this sentence in the federal system. His name is Tony Sparks. Tony was abused as a child and once taken away from his mother and sent to a group home. As a teenager, Tony says, he wanted to grow up to be a Navy SEAL, Special Forces, Green Beret, a military guy. He describes himself as a people's person, but always felt like he had to prove himself. That's what led him to the crowd he was with on June 21st, 1999, when at age 16, he and several others held up and carjacked two youth ministers from Iowa. According to court documents, Tony left the scene after the carjacking. Once he was home, the victims were murdered. Tony pled guilty to carjacking and aiding and abetting because his attorney told him he was going to receive 5 to 15 years in prison. Instead, he received life in prison without the possibility of parole. Earlier this year, now at age 27, we asked him what he would say to a parole board if he was ever given the opportunity to come up for review, and he said, "I'd ask them to grant me a second chance in life, a chance to live life and enjoy it in a positive way, another chance to be that man I was destined to be, that son my parents always wanted me to be, and the family man I always dreamed to become." Like Tony, Joe Sullivan, and Terrence Graham, the majority of people serving life without parole for crimes committed under the age of 18 are African American or Latino. In 11 states, black youth arrested for murder are significantly more likely to be sentenced to life without parole than are white youth arrested for the same crime. And just some additional statistics to provide some context for how this sentence is used in the U.S. Most of the people serving, nearly 60%, were first-time offenders. 25% of them receive the sentence for felony murder, which means that it's not always reserved for the most serious crimes. And in 29 states, the sentence can be given as a mandatory minimum, so there's no judge or jury who's given discretion. So we know that young people can commit horrible crimes, and all of us on this panel certainly agree that they should be held accountable for their actions. If we're going to charge children as adults and put them through adult courts and send them to adult prisons, shouldn't we check up on them when they're actually adults to see if they've grown up? We know kids change. In fact, 3/4 of all youth who commit serious violent crimes during adolescence terminate this activity by age 21. An underdeveloped adolescent brain means that teens often lack the ability to put the brakes on impulsive, sensation-seeking behavior and to resist the influence of their peers. Scientists go on to say that the decline in risky activity after adolescence is due to the new ability to self-regulate as people mature. Now, most U.S. laws reflect these facts about youth. Every state restricts children from voting, serving on juries, purchasing alcohol, or marrying without parental consent. Youth under 18 may not enlist in the military without parental consent. States restrict younger adolescents from a wide range of activities that require more mature judgment, such as driving or consenting to sexual activity. Applying age-appropriate sentences to individuals under the age of 18 is entirely consistent with our society's and the law's recognition that adolescents must not be treated the same way as adults. Everyone in this room was a teenager, some more recently than others, and perhaps some of the people on this panel have children who are teens now. We all know that teens at times have poor judgment and frequently do not consider the consequences of their actions. But can you imagine your child, a younger sibling, or family member doing anything that could justify giving up on them for life? Because that's what sentencing youth to life in prison without the possibility of parole does. Instead, we need to ensure that there are careful periodic reviews of lengthy sentences given to youth who've been convicted of serious offenses to determine if they continue to pose a threat to the community. These youth will still be held accountable. They will spend a decade or two or three away from their homes and families and will only be released if they can prove that they are safe to return to the community in a productive way. This review process works. We know it does. It's done by professionals. For example, Charles Manson has come up for parole and been denied 11 times in the last 30 years. And he comes up again in 2012, and I think we all know what will happen then. But Tony Sparks has never had a parole hearing, and he will never be eligible. Tomorrow is the 20th anniversary of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which details the special needs of youth and therefore the special protections that they require. Shamefully, only the United States and Somalia have not ratified this convention. Still, that does not give us permission to ignore the rights of children in this country and therefore undermine our values. Our nation should be a leader in protecting its youth, a most vulnerable population, rather than one that focuses on the question, at what age is it most appropriate to give up on them? We have a responsibility to change that. We have a responsibility to reform bad public policies that ignore the special characteristics of youth and declare them worthless human beings. Therefore, in order to live in a society that reflects our values, we have a responsibility to end the practice of sentencing youth to life in the prison without the hope of ever being released. Thank you.
so I'll go next. Jody, that was fantastic. First of all, thank you all for having me here. It's great to be here and talk about this very important issue. And I'm going to approach it not so much from policy perspective, but more from a legal perspective. But, of course, policy is what makes law, and so that's important, too, and critical. And I think it's important to start off by kind of framing, give you a little bit of my perspective about criminal justice in general. I think it's fair to say that most, if not all, the draconian criminal justice policies that have come about in our society are the result of reactions to alarmist predictions and false assumptions that later have borne out to be false and completely untrue. And also have often become a tremendous waste of resources. And one need look no further than the tough-on-crime policies and the war on drugs. In 1972, we had 330,000 people in prison, in jail, in the entire country. Today, there are 2.5 million people in jail. 2.5 million. Are we a more safe society now than we were in 1972? Do people use any less drugs now than then? Is crime gone down since then? At the federal level, prisoners are incarcerated on drug charges. That's half of the prison population. And more than 60% of those in prison are of some ethnic minority, black and Latino predominantly. 1 in 8 black men are in prison. 1 in 3 black men are in some form of state supervision, whether that be prison, probation, parole, or jail. So juvenile life without parole is much the same, with one wrinkle. There wasn't any kind of overwhelming state legislative movement to start locking kids up for the rest of their lives. But what you had were a series of predictions that later were borne out to be false. In the early 90s and late 80s about this wave of super predator teenage criminals who are going to commit all these crimes, going to come into these neighborhoods and basically scare people and do all these horrible things. And as it turned out, none of those predictions were true. None of those predictions came to pass. Not a single one of them. And at the same time, you had the reaction to those predictions was this increase in authority for prosecutors and judges to transfer kids into the adult system, and harsher adult sentences. And when you have an amalgam of the two, what ends up resulting is juvenile life without parole. And in much the same way as what's happened with the war on drugs and the tough on crime policies for adults, you have very stark, harsh racial disparities. You have a policy decision that really has not made us any safer and has not really benefited anyone, and has not really worn out to do what it set out, what people said it would do, which was make our community safer, make people feel safer. Now, my legal argument against life without parole sentencing kind of stems in a couple of different ways. First of all, as already mentioned, I think it's undeniable that children are different from adults. I mean, I think that is irrefutable. We were all kids at one point, and as we mentioned, we might have kids. I know I made some very stupid decisions when I was a little kid. I think we all probably did. But things change. You mature. You grow up. Your brain chemistry changes. Your long-term planning changes. Your ability to make decisions changes. And so you can talk about your experience is one evidence that kids are different, but science confirms that as well. All the scientific research talks about judgment, long-term planning, the ability of children to make decisions and make good decisions, their susceptibility to peer pressure, all those types of issues, all borne out by scientific research. But beyond experience, beyond science, the courts tell us the same thing, and the law tells us the same thing as well. If you take a look at most of the laws in our society, that have to do with 18 and under, the ability to vote, to register for the draft, to consent sexually, to get married, in some cases even younger, to drive, all these legal distinctions between children and adults. And then if you take a look at the court, just in 2005, the Supreme Court noted three critical distinctions between children and adults, Roper versus Simmons. And Justice Kennedy said, number one, that children, the susceptibility of juveniles to immature and irresponsible behavior means their irresponsible conduct is not as morally reprehensible as that of an adult because they lack the maturity and possess an underdeveloped sense of responsibility. So they act in impetuous and ill-considered ways. They're more susceptible to negative influences and outside pressures, including peer pressure. And so they have a lack of control and vulnerability. They have a lack of control over their own environment and vulnerability compared to adults. And their character is not as well formed as an adult. Their personality traits are transitory and less fixed. And so juveniles still struggle to define their identity, and that means that it's less supportable to conclude that even a heinous crime committed by a child is evidence of an irretrievably depraved character. So we know that children and adults are different. That's plain and simple. It's very clear. And the Supreme Court, again, has already decided what the confines of life without parole sentencing are for adults. They looked at this case, Kennedy versus Louisiana. It was decided just last year. Heinous crime by an adult, a man who raped his 8-year-old stepdaughter. And the state of Louisiana provided for the death penalty in that type of a case. The Supreme Court said no. Under the Eighth Amendment, the most severe punishment you can provide to an adult for committing that type of a crime, for a non-homicide offense, is life without parole. That's the most severe thing you can do to an adult. So the question then becomes, if you accept the fact that children and adults are different from one another, you accept the fact that the worst punishment you can provide to an adult for a non-homicide offense is life without parole, then you naturally have to treat children and adults differently when you're looking at those types of crimes. Now, of course, kids commit these terrible, horrible crimes, and of course they do these horrendous and horrific things. That's without question, without doubt. But the fact of the matter is that that crime that a child commits does not define him or her for the rest of their entire lives. Because of all the stuff we know about children, the fact that we know that they develop differently, the fact that we know that they still need to develop, the fact that they're not mature yet. And what we're asking for is not that these children be let out of prison tomorrow and right back out on the street, but that rather than throw away all possibility of ever looking at them again, take a look at them at some point down the road, whether that be 15 years, 20 years, I don't know what the proper number is for that. But at some point down the road, because they're children when they commit these crimes, there has to be an effort to revisit the sentencing decision. You know, there's also the funny thing about these cases, and Jody mentioned this, was the fact that there's this harsh and stark disparity between Florida's sentencing and Georgia's sentencing, and the fact that no kids are sentenced to life without parole for nonviolent offenses in Georgia. I think it's, you know, just from my own experience, I practiced in the Bronx, and I can tell you that the crime that Terrence Jamar Graham committed, if he committed the same offense in the Bronx, I can guarantee you that he would not be spending the rest of his life in jail. I can guarantee it. As a matter of fact, I can almost guarantee you that he'd spend a couple of years in jail, and after that would probably go into some type of rehabilitative program, and following that would be reintegrated into society. And so the notion that something that happened like that in the Bronx in New York, for the same type of crime that Mr. Graham was convicted of in Florida, has to be troubling. And it also signals that there is room for something beyond life without parole. There is room to take a look at these kids again. There's a reason for it, because they're going to grow up, they're going to mature, and there's no reason to kind of throw away the key on that.
Thank you very much, Jody and Vincent, for so eloquently presenting the case on behalf of juvenile defendants. Next, we're going to have the case for the government, the government's interest in this matter. And Charles, will you please go first?
Sure. Thanks, Professor, and thanks to the Washington College of Law, and I'm delighted to be here with all three of you. Public policy choices like these are tough. They are. But they have to be based on facts, and I want to make the case for why states should retain the right the constitutional right to impose this sentence in the small number of cases that actually deserve it. This is not the minority opinion. In fact, 44 states, the District of Columbia, and the federal government authorize life-without parole for certain juvenile offenders. Every state Supreme Court and every federal court, including the liberal Ninth Circuit, by the way, has upheld this sentence as constitutional. Just 3 weeks ago, the Minnesota Supreme Court squarely held that this sentence was constitutional. Professor Fan, is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes.
Professor Fan's biography of me was nice. It was fun, long, too long. Set all that aside. For the last 20 years, I've been a local prosecutor in San Diego, a state homicide prosecutor here in Maryland, AUSA, an assistant U.S. attorney here in the District of Columbia, like she was in San Diego, and a military defense lawyer and prosecutor. And now I'm a judge in the military. So for 20 years, I've been defending and prosecuting these folks. So I used to duke it out with guys like Vince and then go drink beers with them afterwards, regardless of how the trial ended. Who among you has had the privilege of interning in a public defender's office or a DA's office yet? Good. That's great. So for the rest of you who haven't and you're interested, you should do it and talk to them, because you've seen things now, don't you, that is different from them reading about it. The vast majority of juveniles, this is the first fact, who commit crimes, who get caught, go to juvenile court. That's the right place for them to be. Every state has a juvenile justice system. That's where they need to be. The purpose of a juvenile justice system in a compassionate country and society like we have is to rehabilitate those of us who've made mistakes. And I joined the Vince Club. I wasn't Mr. Perfect either as a juvenile. I didn't get caught and I didn't do any crimes, but I wasn't perfect. There are juveniles who go to the juvenile justice system in every state who commit murder and rape and robbery, and the right choice is to send them into the juvenile justice system, because that particular case and that particular person, you shouldn't paint with broad brushes, deserves and needs to go in that system. But every state has decided, not out of fear, not in an overreaction, but because it's sound public policy, not bad policy, that juveniles who commit the worst of the worst of the worst crimes can, in limited circumstances, be waived up or sent to adult court. Now, those who graduate to adult court, whether it's mandatory or a discretionary state, most of those who get prosecuted in adult court don't get long sentences. I know, I've prosecuted a bunch of them, and I've defended some. But a very, very, very small number get life without parole. Here's the constitutional argument in its naked form, ugly with all the warts on it. It's this. This is what this other side is saying in essence. You can commit any number of crimes you want, rape, you name it, the day before your 18th birthday, and the Constitution prohibits the state from sending you to jail for the rest of your life. That's the constitutional argument. It doesn't fly. That's why you saw Justice Roberts, for those of you who listened to the argument, try to craft this compromise. And I think that's what we're ultimately going to see, although far be it from me to predict what the Supreme Court's going to do, and no one else here would want to predict with, you know, put money on it either. We can't agree on a lot of things. Number one, discrimination in all forms, especially in the criminal justice system, is just plain wrong. And to the extent that there's a disparate impact on one suspect class or another in the criminal justice system, that's wrong, and we should work to eradicate it. So to the extent that it's true or not true that minorities are adversely impacted in juvenile LWOP sentences, that's wrong, and probably, if it's true, and I don't know if it's true, part of the greater problem in the overall criminal justice system. Second, all juveniles deserve, probably more so than adults, aggressive, ethical, competent lawyers at every stage of the process, from the pretrial stage through the trial through the appellate process. I mean, explaining the rights to a 13 or 14 or 16-year-old takes longer and a deft touch. And I can imagine Vincent was probably very good at it. I mean, you can just see he has a way about him, as opposed to some old codger who doesn't really know how to speak to 14 or 15-year-olds. They need competent counsel. I think we can all agree on that. And many, if not most, juveniles can be rehabilitated. You all made it to law school, and I don't see any halos over your heads, right? And our justice system's not perfect. I mean, I think we all know that that's true. It just happens to be better than all the rest. But let's narrow our discussion here to the topic at hand, life without parole. First off, states don't collect statistics uniformly, especially in the area of juveniles who get waived to adult court. And so when you hear from Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the rest of them that there's 2,225 juveniles serving life without parole, that's a lie. That's a manufactured statistic. And we spell it out in our book that I co-authored, Adult Time for Adult Crimes, which is free. You can get it on your computer right there, or you can email LWOP, L-W-O-P, at heritage.org, get a free copy mailed to you, or just download the chapters. And we show you that those statistics that they created include 18 and 19-year-olds. Last time I checked, those aren't juveniles. They include numbers of people from states when the Attorney General of the state wrote us a letter and said, we don't have anybody of that age and never have in the last 25 years in our system. So treat those numbers with skepticism. There is a number out there, but no one knows what it is because the states don't even know what it is. It's probably somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000. That's number one. Number two, we have a huge juvenile crime problem in our country. And when you look at the crime problem overall in our country compared to the world crime statistics, which we looked at here in our book, we dwarf the next seven countries combined. And on a per capita basis, our folks commit more crimes than other people in the world. It just happens that to be the truth. It's sad, it's disgusting, it's wrong. There's all sorts of reasons for it, but it's true. And so the argument that they're making is, well, yeah, okay, but we shouldn't have this harsh sentence. So we have the worst crime problem with the most deaths per capita, yet we shouldn't have sentences of severe length for the worst of the worst. That doesn't make sound sense to me. That actually sounds like good public policy to have LWOP for the worst of the worst. Next. Setting aside the originalist interpretation of the Eighth Amendment and looking at contemporary analysis, the Roper decision, the 2005 Supreme Court decision which outlawed the death penalty for juveniles, relied on the availability of life without parole as an alternative, as a constitutional alternative to the death penalty. And so what you're seeing now is an attempt to engage in a constitutional bait and switch using the language and logic of Roper, a pure death penalty case where the court has always said death is different and the proportionality analysis is specific to the defendant, and letting it leech over into the non-death penalty arena and asking for proportionality analysis on a case-by-case basis when traditionally what the court has done is deferred to state legislatures. Instead, we're looking at the crime, not the criminal. But it looks like the court may strike a compromise and weave in some sort of proportionality analysis on a case-by-case basis, but not strike down as a constitutional prohibition life without parole for juvenile killers and violent teens. And finally, the last argument that you hear is that under the Convention on the Rights of the Child, we're out of step with the world, we haven't ratified it, we're bad, they're great. Essentially, that's what it is. Well, ratifying a treaty means something. And by the way, look at the Convention Against Torture, or the ICCPR, another human rights treaty, the primary human rights treaty that we've signed and is part of our law. We've taken reservations. Those are exceptions in those treaties. And in those reservations, we have not tied ourselves to the strict prohibitions, but simply said that we'll interpret this prohibition consistent with the 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendments to our Constitutions. So it's very likely that if we did ratify the CRC, which we haven't, we would take those same exceptions that we took in the Convention Against Torture. I know I represented the United States government in Geneva in 2006 when we presented our second periodic report on the Convention Against Torture. I know how we do these things. Finally, 11 other countries specifically authorized life without parole. We're not this lone little speck floating in the cosmos all by ourselves. 11 other countries authorize it. True, they don't have somebody serving that sentence. And dozens of other countries allow exceptionally long sentences for juvenile killers and violent teens. They just don't call it life without parole. So if somebody's serving a 300-year sentence but it's not called life without parole, I guess that's fine. But if you call it life without parole, which it really is, that's not good and it's unconstitutional. It doesn't make sense. Sadly, there are people out there that deserve this sentence. And when you listen, not to these folks, who I think are fun to be with, and I'm privileged to be up here with you guys, but when you read the Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International report and the other key reports out there, they lie to you. They whitewash the facts of the crime. Let me give you one example, and I'll leave you with this. There's a cause celeb that Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International has, named Ashley Jones. Here's all they say about what she did. Now, we got the real facts from the judge, which I'll read you in a second. Quote, at 14, Ashley tried to escape the violence and abuse by running away with an older boyfriend who shot and killed her grandfather, an aunt, her grandmother, and sister who were injured during the offense want Ashley to come home. Let me tell you what the little angel really did. Notice the passive language, calling her a child, meant to evoke sympathy. This is what the little murderess did. In a span of minutes, Ashley Jones and her boyfriend shot and killed her grandfather twice in the face and stabbed him until he died, shot her sleeping aunt three times, shot her grandmother in the shoulder, and then stabbed her, poured lighter fluid on her, set her on fire, watched her burn, and then stabbed her 10-year-old sister 14 times. Ashley then took $300 from her grandfather's wallet and the keys to his Cadillac, which she drove away from the crime scene. So if you listen to the propaganda campaign that these are misspent use, don't deserve this sentence, and then you look at the actual facts, which we took the liberty of writing 243 DA offices around the country, and we highlight 16 case digests in this book, which I brought a few extra copies you can have. You can read the judge's findings in these cases and make up your mind whether it's good or bad public policy. Most juveniles deserve to be rehabilitated. Sadly, we live in a society where we have some people who don't. And so don't make up your mind based on sympathy or emotion. Base it on facts. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor. Humbled to be here with this esteemed panel. My name is Scott Burns, and I am the Executive Director of the National District Attorneys Association. For 16 years as an elected prosecutor, I was in the victim business. And we heard about Terrence, and we heard about Joe, and we heard about Tony, and we asked questions about guessing states, but can anybody tell me the names of any of their victims? Can you tell me the name of the 72-year-old woman that Terrence raped brutally, having committed 17 prior crimes, by the way? They don't mention the victims. And the best part about Coley's study, and I really do urge you to read it, it's one of those things, I get them all the time, and I play like I read them, and I don't. But it has the victims in there, and it tells the story. If Gabrielle was the prosecutor, he actually called Gabrielle. If Coley was the defense attorney, actually called Coley, called the judges, got the police reports, got the real facts of what happened. We all talked a little bit about how we got here. When I was sitting where you were sitting, I married the editor-in-chief of the Law Review because she was really pretty and really smart, and I was about flunking out. And I told her we could go back to my hometown of Cedar City, Utah. She was from Santa Barbara. She really didn't want to go to Cedar City, Utah, but she did. And my dad had been a defense attorney, and he had been a district attorney, and he had been a judge for 20 years. So there's our little town. We had a good name and a good reputation, and there's hope. We made a lot of money. The first 2 years in practice, I think, and this was 20, 25 years ago, $250,000, $300,000 a year. That was big money back then. Had an airplane case, tragically, that settled and got a whole bunch of money right off the bat. Paid off all my student loans, bought a house, brand new Land Cruiser. Great, great money. And it was fun, and I loved it. And then one day, Ira, that's his name, Ira Shopman, been the sheriff for about 30 years, called and said, he used to call me little feller, hey, little feller, we need to go get a Coke. So I got in the car with Ira, and Ira drove to the county seat. And he said, I got to run in and see the clerk. Why don't you come in? So I went in with Ira. And the clerk, Dave Yardley, and Ira said, your dad's on the phone. And I said, all right. I said, what's up, Dad? Do you know what today is? I don't know what today is. What's today? Today is the last day to file for county attorney. And I said, why would I file for county attorney? Because at some point you need to be and learn to be a real lawyer, to go into a courtroom to actually argue something instead of sending a letter back and forth, counter offer, no, ooh, what's my cut of this? $33,000, oh, that sounds good, pencil it out, let's close this deal. And that's all I've been doing for 2 or 3 years. And I said, Dad, what does it pay? He said, it pays $38,000 a year. I said, two things. One, I'm not a member of the predominant religion of Utah. Two, I think we're the wrong party. And three, you got to be hitting me for $38,000. And he said, today is the last day to file. There's 5 minutes left. And no one else wants the job, so I think you can win. And he was right. It wasn't by a lot, but they had no one else to vote for. And so in 1987, I became the duly elected Iron County attorney. And I'm going to do it for one term. That's it. I'm going to learn how to try cases. I'm going to point at somebody and say, you can't handle the truth. And I'm going to pound on the table. I'm going to learn to be a real lawyer. And about the first week I was there, you can't make this up, I got a police report. It was a six-year-old girl. She was a Native American. And her stepfather had been abusing her mother. And in this particular case, he grabbed her by the hair. He pulled her down the hall. He slammed her head into the wall. Then he took her into the shower, turned it on scalding hot, and held it, her under the hot water, till it burned all the way down her back. And I remember looking at those photographs, and I remember when I met with her and with her mother, and it was different. It wasn't about the money anymore. It wasn't about my cut. Those of you that play sports or are engaged in something that you're passionate about, it became that. And I woke up 16 years later, and I was still doing it, and I would have done it for free because I'm in the victim business. Our job is to deal with and take care of victims. Now, the issue before you, and I think as Coley has pointed out, we've talked about different states and how many here and how many there. States are different. You know, they don't grow oranges in Alaska. They don't do things in Louisiana that we do in Montana or Utah. And that's the system that we live under. It would be nice, it would be so nice if we could just make everything smooth and easy, state by state, have one rule, one law, where we could compare Michigan to Montana or Texas to Florida. But we don't. We respect the right of citizens to elect prosecutors to make decisions. We elect legislators in states that pass laws. Coley told you, 43 states. Those were people that got elected, that represent the will of the people that decided that this was a law that was appropriate in their state. The other thing that's important, and behind, and I'll just quit talking so we can have some discussion, but we talked about the war on drugs and, you know, how many people are in prison for drugs. There's always a story behind the story. And as law students and as great lawyers in the future, I would just urge you to not take things at face value, but to do the research, to do the work. We talked about the number of people with ethnicity that are in prison. A lot of that is crack cocaine. There's 101 disparity for crack cocaine. I was in a hearing 2 weeks ago, Chairman Conyers was there. What a gentleman, what a bright man. Bobby Scott, Congressman Scott, chaired the hearing. But what they didn't remember when we were talking about racial disparity was the fact that Charles Rangel sponsored the bill, was the fact that it was the Black Caucus of the United States Congress that supported the bill. It was because people of ethnicity said, our inner cities are wrecked. People can't walk to school. People are stepping over crack pipes and needles. We deserve the protection of the law. And Chairman Conyers said, I don't believe you. The witness held up a list of co-sponsors. That's where that law came from. So, you know, now we're talking about reducing disparity. All in favor of discussing the reduction in disparity between crack and powder cocaine, if that's what we want to do. We're talking about not sentencing juveniles to life without parole or harsh sentences. Everybody's willing to sit down and talk about it. But there is a price to pay because crime is down. Crime is down 30% overall in the last 20 years. Violent crime is down 30%. Property crimes, burglaries, I believe 42%. So we have found that when we find the worst of the worst, the multiple serial offenders, and we lock them up and we take them off the street, wow, I mean, think of the logic. Crime goes down because a very small percentage commit crime after crime. Another interesting thing, again, we talked about low-level drug offenders, and we did a study the last year that I was at the White House. Everybody kept talking about, we got to get rid of the low-hanging fruit. Let's let these, you know, people that are possessing dope out of prison. My God. We tried to find a 35-year-old guy or a 21-year-old woman or anybody that was serving time in prison for having a bag of weed. He or she does not exist. The average person serving a federal or state prison term for possession of marijuana, the average amount was 90 pounds. And that was plea bargained down in 80% of the cases, and it gets technical, but if you're going to learn about it, you got to know. 80% of those were plea bargained down for major trafficking cases. So to say somebody is in prison for possession of marijuana, that was true, but usually after multiple offenses. It is hard to earn a prison cell in the 50 states in our country. It is really hard. And if you ever have the opportunity to go to a correctional facility, or those of you that work in public defender or prosecutor's office, or look at the jackets of people that are in prison, I promise you, judges go out of their way, prosecutors go out of their way, defense attorneys certainly do go out of their way to do whatever we can to help, to rehabilitate, to get treatment. But after all of those things fail, and after multiple offenses, and after looking at the protection of the victims, because we're in the victim business, then they receive that sentence. Juvenile life without parole. I have prosecuted cases, as has Coley, I'm sure, where it is one of the most difficult decisions you're going to make. But when you are entrusted in protecting the public And I have to go home and put my head on the pillow at night and not worry that you're going to be robbed or shot or that you're going to be assaulted. My job is to protect the public. And I don't call him Tony, and I don't call him Joey, and I don't call him Terry or Terrence, or I don't call him children or youth. I call that little who has committed 23 felonies and just raped a 72-year-old woman, I call you an inmate. And my job is to take you off the street and to lock you up as long as I can to protect the public. That's the other side of it.
Extraordinarily eloquent presentations all, and it strikes me that there are three things about which our panelists, who come from very different positions, have, there's no dispute. There's no dispute, number one, as far as I can tell, correct me if I'm wrong, that as the prosecutors do so brilliantly, because it's the prosecutor's job, there is no dispute that juveniles can commit horrible crimes, hurt people horribly, and there are victims that the public cares to vindicate. There's no dispute, I think, about that. There is also, as far as what interests me, is there also has been no dispute that when we're young, we do stupid things. And we change. We do things that we regret, and we change. And indeed, physiologically, we're not as capable of restraining ourselves from doing stupid things when we're juveniles. There seems to be no dispute about that from any of our panelists from these very different positions. And the third thing about which there can be no dispute is that if you, even if you change as you grow and mature, if you're stuck in jail without the possibility of parole, it doesn't matter that you're a whole new person a decade from now, 2 decades from now, you're still stuck in jail without the possibility of parole. There can be no dispute about that. Now, the fundamental question that that seems to be posed and that the court is facing is whether juvenile status is different. We talked about how you probably learned in your criminal law class that when you bring an Eighth Amendment claim of excessive punishment, it's very, very hard to win. It's very, very hard to win on a disproportionality analysis. And it's easier if it's a capital case because death is different. As Chief Justice Roberts pointed out during oral arguments, however, in the cases 10 days ago, in the juvenile cases 10 days ago, juvenile status is also different as well. And so the question is juvenile status so different such that the freedom of the states to enact harsh penalties for juveniles should be curtailed? And should we leave it to Congress or the state legislatures, or should we constitutionalize this prohibition such that there is no room anymore to enact such punishments? And moreover, what do we do about the evidence indicating the gross racial disparities in who gets this harshest of punishment? There is no dispute among any of our panelists that there is racial disparity in who actually gets this most harsh of penalties for juveniles. And so these are all difficult questions to ponder as we have our discussion tonight. I'm sure you have many, many more, so I'll just raise them and open it up to you. Just raise your hand and we'll call.
Hello, I'm Ernestine Elaine Dawson. I'm actually not a law student. I'm actually a government policy student at Johns Hopkins University. And my question is, back in May of 2009, there was a bill introduced, H.R. 2289. I wonder if you can all give me your perspective of how that law in particular will or could change life without the life sentences for juveniles.
This is Bobby Scott's bill?
Yes.
It's not going anywhere. It's been reintroduced. How many times has it been up? 2 years? 3 years? It has one co-sponsor. Look, crime's a local issue, usually. It's usually a matter left to the states. I think Rachel's provocative questions to tease up this discussion were good, and one of the points I feel very strongly about is, the federal government has no role in dictating what states can do. I mean, we have 50 state experiments for a reason, and the District of Columbia sets its own laws as well. It's up to the states. Now, of course, if the Supreme Court paints with a broad brush and finds it unconstitutional, that's the end of the story. But Bobby Scott's bill has no momentum. It's not going anywhere. I understand his. He's a good guy. and we've had him at our foundation for lunch, and we've talked to him about this sort of thing. We work with him on a number of other important matters like overcriminalization, which Jody worked on for a while, which is a big problem. But it's not going anywhere, in my opinion.
Just to answer your question, what the bill would do is that it would take away funding from the states that don't allow for review after 15 years of sentences imposed on youth, sentences of life without parole imposed on youth, and it would also eliminate that practice in the federal system. And I do think, you know, there was a hearing on the bill in June, and at that hearing, there was a witness, a victim who testified in opposition to the bill, a victim who testified in support of the bill, and I do want to talk about the victim's business too, because I'm glad that you're in that. I think we had, trying to recall, I think it was a former prosecutor also who was in support. So the issues that came up at that hearing and that Cully has mentioned deal with states' rights. And those are the same issues that were set aside for the sex offender laws that have been passed in the last few years. So we have to question whether these states' rights issues are being raised for political reasons or for legitimate reasons. And again, when we go back to looking at whether this is good policy, I think it's important to recognize that our federal government and Congress have a responsibility to ensure that around the country we have good, sound policies that reflect our values and fairness. And I just wanted to add two quick things, just in reference to some of the data that is in dispute. This is not the place, the forum for debating data, I don't think necessarily, but I do want to flag two things for you. One is a letter that Human Rights Watch wrote to the Heritage Foundation in response to their report explaining the methodology, again, that was used in order to find the data. And it was a comprehensive search, and I think we can all agree that data collection is very difficult on this issue, but it does explain in detail what was done in order to gather the numbers that have consistently been used to demonstrate how this practice is being used around the country. And I do have a copy of that letter here with me, also for free, so you should feel free to look at that. We also sent a letter to the NDAA as they were considering a resolution around the state's rights issue on juvenile life without parole. Unfortunately, the NDAA did not see it as a priority to have a diverse forum like this one. When they discussed their resolution, they heard only from someone from the Heritage Fed. It was
me.
There we go. And someone from a victims organization that opposes life without parole. So we took it upon us to read into the footnotes of the Heritage Foundation report and compile the data that is actually accurate based on the very sources that were used for the report, and I have a copy of that with me as well, and happy to provide that to anyone interested in the facts that the real facts that were laid out there. And in terms of the victim's business, I think that it's really important, as you know, as somebody in the victim's business, to acknowledge that not all victims agree about what appropriate punishment is. And not all victims find healing in harsh sentences. Linda White, Robert Holscher, Akilah Shirelles, Angela Williams, these are all names of victims. Victims who filed an amicus brief with the petitioners in Sullivan and Graham because they believe that sentencing youth to life in prison without the possibility of parole is too harsh, despite the fact that they've lost loved ones to juvenile crime. So I think it's important as we talk about this issue and the diverse support that we have for reform to include that this is, you know, an issue that impacts victims on both sides, for sure.
But every major victims' rights organization in the country signed on to the victims' rights brief that's an amicus brief in the juvenile LWOP cases. And so that's true. It's amazing how forgiving some victims are. I mean, I'm sure you've dealt with it, Vince, as a defense attorney, and you, Scott. But that tends to be a more of a minority opinion. Most victims want their pound of flesh. I mean, whether it's reasonable or not, they want it. And sometimes it's difficult for prosecutors to deal with victims because they want too much.
I think it's also important to acknowledge that we aren't creating sentencing laws based on the specific needs of victims, despite the terrible losses that they have experienced. It's based on what we think and know is fair.
What if you get elected to be a district attorney, we could pass enough laws where we could just tell you what to do. I don't know that you'd even need a law degree. And part of the job of being the prosecutor is I actually do sit down with the victim. I do take into account what he or she wants. And each and every case is different. Every single one is different. And that, I think, makes the fundamental point about why from state to state, from legislature to legislature, from elected prosecutor, from case to case, and taking into account what the victims want, that's our system. That's how we mete out justice.
I guess there's one small point I want to make just before we move on to a couple of other questions. I agree with Jody that victims are not a monolithic community of people. And while people have suffered terrible, terrible losses and have there's a wide diversity of opinions about what the appropriate punishment for the perpetrators of those crimes actually is. And then second, this whole argument about states' rights, it's very convenient, it's very, very helpful for a district attorney to make those types of arguments. But that ignores the fact that we have three branches of government. And the courts are there and designed to determine what's constitutional. And so when states act in unconstitutional ways, that's when the court steps in and says you can't do that. That's what happened in Brown versus Board of Education. When the same arguments we made about segregation, and I'm not comparing juvenile life without sentencing. I'm not asserting those same motives.
Yeah.
But what I am saying is that, you know, states being grounds for experiment can lead to very, very bad things. And I know that's true of the courts as well, but courts are there to protect people's rights and to ensure that things are not done in violation of the Constitution. And that's what the courts are for.
Can I just respond to that briefly? As prosecutors, we take our victims as we get them. We don't get to pick the ethnicity. I don't think anybody on this panel is going to disagree that the vast majority of crimes are committed on the same race as the victim. Came out in the racial disparity hearing. Stop committing crimes then. Don't rape. Don't murder. Don't rob. Because when I get the oath, you know what? I've got an African American that's seven this week. It's just too many. Oh, I got a white guy here. We don't have. That's not how it works. Most of the time, you don't know the ethnicity of the defendant or the victim for why you're making the charging decision. So if we want to change that, stop committing the crimes.
I think you probably know the ethnicity of the defendant when you're making a charging decision.
How would you?
You don't get a file or any type of information about who committed the crime that has anything to do with their race. Don't take my words out of context. I'm not casting any aspersions on your choices. But what I am saying is there is a big difference between the way a law is enforced and who is enforced against and how it's executed against certain people. And that is not something that I'm saying that you're personally involved with, but I don't think you can go to a prison and look at the population there and say that black people or Hispanic people are the most dangerous people in this country. I don't think you can do that if you live in the suburbs. I don't think you can do that if you live in a city. Okay? Crimes, laws are enforced differently in different places, and people see things differently in different places. That may be based on their experience. That may be based on other things. But without question, there's a racial disparity in the criminal justice system. And without question, it's not because black people and brown people are the most dangerous people and the only people who are committing crimes. I mean, that's absurd.
Questions? Jared.
My name is Jared Conforte. I'm a student here at WCL. Mr. Stimson, I know that we're not here to argue numbers or statistics, but I just wanted to point out, I'm from Nebraska, and not only are we known for William Jennings Bryan and a unicameral legislature, but we're also known for, in that state, you are a juvenile until you're 19 years old. So... I would just like to point that out for people that, you know, if that is included in the statistic, then for that particular state, if someone's sentenced to life without parole at age 18, then they technically are a juvenile for that practical purpose.
Great, great Cornhusker fact of the day. Appreciate it. And our criticism and critique of Amnesty International Human Rights Watch report was based on their definition of what juveniles were. And in fact, the Texas legislature that Jody referenced, they abolished LWOP for juveniles, which they defined as 16 and below. For 17, it's okay. So you're right, Jared. The states do define it differently, but our critique of their methodology was based on their definitions and the responses they got back from the states.
Okay.
Yeah, but no, that's a good point.
Do you want me to explain the methodology quickly? So they said the way that they, because it's difficult to figure out what the DOC data is, they often don't collect the date of offense, right? And so we are to assume that in some places we have to look at how long it was between when the person might have committed a crime and came into custody at a particular facility. And so in some cases where they weren't able to access court documents, which in most they were either using court documents or DOC data directly, they were looking at whether somebody entered the DOC at 19, in which case, in many cases, their offense was committed long before that. Because as many of you know, these trials for more serious crimes often take a long time, and then there's a sentencing phase as well. And so that is what the gap is.
That's one of the many flaws in their methodology, which, by the way, they admit in their paper, if you read it, which we liberally quote in our footnotes.
Put in the back. Great, jump ahead. My name is Mariana Dominguez, and I had a question for Mr. Stimson. You mentioned that you have what's called adult time for adult crimes, but these people that we're talking about, they're not adults. So how do you address the empirical research that shows that the human brain is not developed enough to make analytical reasons understand, you know, the consequences of their crime, as well as impulse control? Some studies say not until age 22 or 23. So how do you address those specific facts when we're talking, I mean, about non-homicide, too?
Marianne, is that what it is?
Mariana.
Mariana. Sorry, I hate it when people mess up my name, because I got a weird one. You bring up two good points. Let me tackle them both quickly. One is, it's not me who's defining what a juvenile is. It's the states. And my argument is more nuanced than some would try to paint it to be. My argument isn't that we need these sentences and gosh darn it, they should all have it. My argument is states have the sovereign right through their state elected representatives to define who a juvenile is. Jared, 18, 19, Nebraska, 16, Texas. So it's the states who define where juveniles are, and the state legislatures decide at what age can you be waived up to adult court. We're talking about teenagers in juvenile life without parole. We're not talking about people 12 and below. So no state waives people up to life without parole. No, there are no cases of that. That's number one. But number two, I'm really glad you brought up this frontal lobe development theory. That's why that we orchestrated and pulled together an expert amicus brief in this two Supreme Court cases that showed that the vast majority of states in their trial court hearings to determine whether the experts this theory was readily admissible rejected. It is a theory in development. It is not generally accepted as scientific fact yet. It may be, it may not be, but judges are rejecting that theory more often than they're accepting that theory. People commit crimes, brains don't. And that's what the amicus brief says. So here's something to noodle about when we're having a cocktail out there. Why is it that juveniles in the United States commit crimes far more than juveniles in any other country on a per capita basis, based on the UN crime statistics, which we have in my book. Yet, they don't do that in other states, in other countries. Is it that, for some strange cosmic reason, juvenile brains in the United States, just American juvenile brains, have a frontal lobe problem? No, it's not. And so this theory that's being floated out there, and maybe the scientific evidence out there will be developed such that it's true, is a theory. And so it's not me telling you this. I'm telling you the statistics out there that show the judges are denying this to be entered in their courtrooms more often than they're admitting it.
Questions in the back.
So my name is Saeed, by the way, and my question is directed to Ms. Kent, I think. Did I get that wrong?
Yeah.
I'd be happy if all of you responded to. But when I was hearing your argument, what I noted was, so everybody as a juvenile or a young person does silly things, of course, you know, granted, that's true. But I was just wondering, like, it seems like to make that, and then of course we change and we become different persons. But I'm just wondering, when crimes or actions by minors are so egregious as the two people at the end have...
the two homely white guys.
Sorry.
The two old guys.
Yeah. Vividly pointed out, does that degree of sort of lack of judgment not portend something far worse? What kind of person that person might become? And so, essentially, like, if the crimes are, you know, so egregious, why shouldn't the punishments be commensurate with the egregiousness of the crimes? And sort of, like, related to that, you said something about arbitrariness. I was wondering if you could sort of parse that. What do you mean by arbitrariness? Like, in terms of, like, is it arbitrary in the sense that the people who commit these horrible actions and the sentences they get, what's the relation? I mean, are these people actually not committing? I was thinking that there should be a relationship between what they do and the punishment they get. And the arbitrariness would be that, well, the punishments they get are not in any sort of nice way related to what they did. Is that what you mean by arbitrary?
Sure.
And so, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I can answer both of those questions. So, on the first question around the severity of the crime and the fact that they're youth and how do those fit together? I think the answer to your question is that we don't know what's going to happen, whether that person who displays some terrible judgment, who does something horrific, we just don't know if they're going to turn into a better person, whether they're going to grow. What we know is that they have the capacity to do so. So therefore, it's our responsibility to ensure that the laws and the books are fair enough so that we can go back and check once they are adults to see if they have changed. And that's what we're asking for here. We're not suggesting that these people be released. We're suggesting that there be a review to see if they have changed later in life. So that's the answer to your first question, I think. The second question about whether this is an arbitrary sentence. So I think there are a few ways to provide examples of how it's used arbitrarily. First, life without parole being the most severe sentence a youth could provide or could receive makes us think that it would be used for the absolute worst crimes only. But in some states, you don't even have to be at the place where the crime happens, and you could still receive that sentence. You could have left the scene completely when somebody is murdered. Yes, there are lives lost, and it is a horrible crime. But for those people who've left, should they still receive the most severe sentence? In that case, I would argue that it is being imposed somewhat arbitrarily. 25% of the people serving the sentence are serving it for felony murder. Excuse me. So that raises questions about whether we're actually using it for the most serious crimes. And then I think it's important to look at the data and look at where this sentence is being used. Because in New York, where there's nobody serving the sentence, I would say people probably feel comfortable in their communities, just as comfortable as anybody in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Louisiana, Florida, or California. And yet they don't use this sentence to keep their community safe.
So when you look at why they do in these five states that have two-thirds of the people surveyed, it raises questions about how that happened. And Vince alluded to something earlier about how there's been a confluence of laws passed over the last 20, 30 years that have resulted in this sentence being imposed more harshly in some states than in others, or more frequently in some states than in others. It's easier to get this sentence in Pennsylvania than it is in New York. But why is that? It seems arbitrary to me when you look at it that way.
Can I just make one brief point and ask you to keep this in mind every time they talk about parole? I mean, what if someone changes parole? And they always use Charles Manson. Go ask the LaBianca family what it's like every 5 years when Charlie comes up. Go ask Sharon Tate's family. Go talk to a victim who will tell you they are re-victimized every time the guy that killed their daughter comes up for parole. Because they got to get fired up again. They have to go through it all again. Sometimes they have to get letters or petition. Again, from the victim's perspective.
Questions? Yes.
My name is Megan. I'm a student here. And I just have a question, I guess, for all of the panelists regarding how easy it is to get a life without parole sentence. There was a kind of theme of mandatory sentencing. And I was wondering if that one is the case in these cases of one of the reasons it's easier to receive this sentence in certain states, and whether that affects the, or should affect the constitutionality of life without parole that's not being offered on a discretionary basis, on a basically a hard line, bright line.
I neglected to repeat the questions. We're actually podcasting this session for those who can't make it. So I'm going to repeat the questions, summarize them, so that it records on the podcast. And the question is the frequency of actually people getting, juveniles getting life without parole, whether or not there are mandatory schemes in which juveniles get life without parole. And if there are mandatory schemes, how does that figure in the calculus of constitutionality?
That is a very good question. In terms of how that calculates into the constitutionality, I think although you know some states are mandatory, some states are not, the bottom line is the question of whether or not the judge has the option of sentencing a child to life without parole. So I don't know that that actually. I mean, I think it makes it more harsh. I think there are also situations where some judges didn't even know that that was, you know, possible, and end up dealing with kids and sentencing kids in these situations to life without parole without having the knowledge that you know a child will spend the rest of their lives in jail. But I don't think it necessarily factors into the constitutional analysis of this, the ending the practice altogether under the Eighth Amendment.
Questions? Yes.
I'm going to stand up so I can see you all. My name is Evan. I'm 1L here. to Mr. Stimson, I come from Georgia, so big proponent of states' rights. I'm not going to give you a Georgia factoid of the day, don't worry.
I want to hear one.
to both of you prosecutors, I think, especially when you come to a place like this, I'm sure you're getting yourselves ready to, you know, have to defend your life's work, but I think all of us appreciate the fact that you keep us safe when we sleep. And I think that's God's work. I mean, it's like one of the most important things in the world. What I think we keep dancing around is sort of what is the difference between life without parole and life and the chance of parole? And why should juveniles in particular not be given the chance of parole 30 years down the line, 40 years down the line? Mr. Burns, you bring up the point of parole hearings being very traumatic for the people involved. And I think that's certainly true. It should not be, you know, given... No, wait. But there's also the argument that, you know, the most emotionally interested parties should not be the ones doling out justice. So, you know, if someone were to kill a loved one of mine, I don't think I would be the best person to weigh the scales of justice. That's your job and the court's job. But I guess the question I have is, why should we not allow people to be reevaluated? Why are we so afraid to allow a reevaluation later on for people who commit crimes under the age of 18 or 19 as juveniles when there is such a great potential for change? We're talking about people that you know, perhaps did things when they're 14, 15, 16. You know, latest case with that gang rape behind the school being a perfect example of some of the atrocious, horrible things that can happen. But 40 years down the line, it's still going to be atrocious. And they're going to be reviewed for the crime that they committed for their parole hearing. So do you not trust parole parole committees, or is it, what is the point that makes you not willing to give this reevaluation? That's my question.
Quickly, I'll restate the question. Fundamentally, the question is, why do we even have these sentences where we don't have the possibility of parole? Why? The wisdom of this scheme.
Evan, I hope you become a litigator. You have a very nice way about you, regardless of which side of the courtroom you're on. You know, it's prosecutors and defense attorneys and judges who keep us safe. You know, when I was a defense attorney, I felt as if my position in the court was just as important, if not more so, than that of the government counsel. And so it's worthwhile work on either side of the aisle. The issue is not whether you're scared of parole hearings. Parole hearings don't decide the sentence. The sentence was decided by the judge, or in states like Virginia, the jury, where they sentence, or in the military, where the jury sentences. I think the point that Scott was making, which is true, if you've ever attended a parole hearing, is that since the sentence was decided, what impact, if any, does it have on the victim's families, oftentimes who are older than the defendant, who die off, and then there is no voice for the victim community at those parole hearings. And there's another issue related to that, and that is this. People who serve LWOP sentences can have very meaningful existences within prisons. It's not the kind you or I would choose, but they can turn to faith, they can get an education. Most of these education programs aren't funded well enough. I agree with these guys because I know what they're going to say next. They can do meaningful things. They can also and need to have qualified appellate counsel and pursue their appeals with vigor. Some of these cases are overturned on appeal and resentenced to non-LWOP sentences, and they can seek clemency, and sometimes they're successful in getting clemency because they've demonstrated to the governor that they're worthy of spending time outside of the prison wall. And so don't think that it's lock away, gone forever, bye-bye, see ya for every single one of them. It is not likely that clemency will be granted, but it does happen.
I think the just to follow up on your point, you know, the notion that a child can have a meaningful existence in prison and can make a life in prison where they're commingled with adult prisoners, adult offenders, they're subject to all types of sexual violence, all types of regular violence, and you know, beyond the fact that the rehabilitative programs for a child in prison are underfunded and understaffed and not helpful in a lot of ways, what is it that a child is supposed to be rehabilitating for? If the only opportunity they know that awaits them is to die in their prison cell. What is exactly the point of a child? Where is a child's motivation supposed to come from to better him or herself in prison, to make a life of their life in prison, if what they know they're facing is to die there? You know, the notion that clemency or the appellate route is actually a means for a child or a child who's then grown up into an adult to get out of prison is a bit far-fetched. Clemency is a grace granted by the executive branches of most state governments, and by and large, clemency is not a route for anyone, children or adults alike, to ever be released. And furthermore, the overwhelming majority of these children who have committed these crimes, who are going to be reviewed by parole boards, a lot of them are not going to get out, and that's true. But we trust parole boards to make these types of decisions every day. There are about 5.5 million people on probation or parole in this country, and those officials are able to make those decisions. I understand the problems that victims face with having to relive the crimes and relive the incidents, but there are alternatives to victims being present at every single parole hearing. There are alternatives, and again, the notion that all victims are think in one mind in one way just doesn't justify kind of a blanket rule that parole is never going to be able to be an option for a child.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, in the back.
I agree with you on the fact that, Mr. Sutherland, that there shouldn't necessarily be a blanket rule, but I want to pose this question to you and Ms. Kent, just to play devil's advocate, because I don't necessarily agree with Mr. Simpson on the point that, well, you know, they have an opportunity to better themselves and so forth. Quite honestly, if there's no possibility that I'll ever get out, why am I learning to read and educate myself? I'm not going to leave and go get a job. So I just don't understand that. But on the flip side, I would like to know, for situations like the youth in Chicago who brutally beat this teenager and they caught it on video and it was just an awful, horrible crime. So do you feel, what would be an appropriate punishment? What do you think would be an appropriate punishment for a situation like that? Do you think that it's really feasible to expect that youth can be sentenced and then they'll really be rehabilitated, you know, once they leave? Like, what do you really think is going to happen? Because you mentioned these policy reasons against sentencing juveniles to life without parole. But what policy is really, what's really happening on the other end in terms of rehabilitation? Is that really happening? There's so many juveniles in the system. So what's your answer to that?
I mean, I think your question is a good one, because the real answer is we don't know what's going to happen. Okay, we don't know if every child can be rehabilitated. We don't know if every child is going to grow up and be, you know, completely perfect. But what we're talking about is recognizing the difference between a child and an adult, and recognizing that the people who committed those crimes in Chicago, that terrible crime that was caught on tape, where they beat that other child to death, those were children too. And you know, some of them were older children, some of them were younger children, but they were all kids. And the only way you can figure out if a child is going to be rehabilitated is to take a look far down the road, after they've been sentenced, after they've been convicted and sentenced, and see where their head is at. And that's really what the issue is. I mean, you know, I can give you thousands of examples of people who committed terrible things when they were young and done terrible things when they were a child or children or even very young men and ended up just fine.
But what's terrible?
Terrible is my grandfather stabbed somebody in the stomach and cut them from one side of the stomach to the other, an attempted murder. That's my grandfather. He got out of prison after 10 years and completely turned his life around. That's terrible. Terrible is anytime somebody is hurt like that. But that doesn't mean you throw that person away forever, particularly when they're a child. You know, that's what the gist of it is. You can think about the most horrible crime you could ever imagine. Is the person that committed that crime more than that crime themselves? Yes.
You want to know why that bothered you?
Please.
Because you saw it on tape.
I did.
And that happens every week in America. It bothers you like Megan. Remember the little girl that was let off and we saw I couldn't sleep after that. They found her brutalized and raped later. Because you saw it. And when you're part of the system and it's your brother or your sister or your mother, it changes things. When you're there to see it and be involved in it, when you become a lawyer, either a defense attorney or a prosecutor or a judge someday, law enforcement officers. The last capital murder case I tried, Tiburon Dave Honey took a rock. He broke in a sliding glass window. He went in to try and find his girlfriend who wasn't there, but Claudia Benn was there, his girlfriend's mother, with three little children. And by the time he was done, he had raped her ante-mortem, meaning while she was alive, with a 13-inch serrated butcher knife. After he raped her, what was left He had sexual relations with her. He bit a chunk out of her back. These three little girls were bathed in blood. The neighbor called when he heard the bang of the rock, and in less than 15 minutes, by the time he got there, he had also sexualized two of the children. So as you as a prosecutor have to go there and see him screaming in blood and see these children and see that the way he killed her is he pulled her head back and literally there was only skin on the back of her neck. He decapitated her. It's different when you see it and when you're involved in it.
It's also important to think that the vast majority of crimes do not rise to that level. Okay, the vast majority of crimes that people are in prison for do not rise to that level.
You know, one of the things I learned during my year and a half study to write this book was that, as Vince pointed out, some states, when they waive juveniles up to adult court, make them serve their pretrial time with adults. That's just wrong. That's stupid. That's bad policy. That should change. States should move to change that. But that doesn't mean they should blow up the system. You know, it's weird. The other thing I learned is that, and I've learned this over a couple decades, is that people, regardless if they're one day shy of their 18th birthday, or they're 18, or 25, or 50, when they commit a crime and they get life without parole, have one thing in mind once they get past the trauma of being convicted and sentenced, and that is, how can I better my situation? And what you find prisoners doing is, in their own way, trying to figure out, most of them, not all, how can I better my situation? So, do I get more privileges if I do this? Do I get more privileges if I do that? Do I work in the library? Do I work here? Do I work there? It's not a life any of us would choose. But what I'm saying is, the reality is that, setting the despair aside, which is clearly there, and the mental health problems, and the drug abuse, and the alcohol problems, which is pervasive in our jails, and juveniles are probably no different, that they will, for the most part, try to do things that better their existence. It's interesting. The juvenile justice system is called the juvenile justice system, not the children justice system. The only people that call teenagers, and that's what we're talking about, children, are the advocates for them. And they don't use that word in court. It's called the juvenile justice system. That's what judges, probation officers, and defense attorneys call it. The word child is meant to evoke sympathy. These are teenagers.
Question, yes.
My name's Ian. I'm a 1L here. So having not taken constitutional law yet, I was just wondering if there's any room in this case and in the constitutional evaluation of whether a punishment is cruel and unusual, whether or not that punishment does not decrease rates of crime or maybe even increases rate of crime, and whether that can ever come into that calculation. And then Mr. Burns, you were saying, and this sort of departs a little bit from jail law, but you know, you talked about protecting victims. Certainly, I'm sure you included protecting potential future victims. And would it be convincing evidence if a criminal justice policy in fact increased crime? And the reason I ask that is, I worked for an organization that dealt with the issue of trying youth as adults. And during the time I was there, two government agencies, the CDC and OJJDP, released reports that this practice, very strongly, that this practice increases crime. Yet, clearly, that always wasn't entirely persuasive for people making these decisions. So, those two questions.
We're short on time and full on questions, so I'll just let you go. Please, thank you.
I think in terms of like a straight Eighth Amendment analysis, the question of whether or not a policy is more or less increases or decreases crime doesn't actually factor in, just in terms of straight legal mannerisms. But, you know, I'm a realist, you know, and I think that judges are human beings, obviously. And, you know, I think anybody who's looking at this issue is probably going to, you know, think about that in their vacuum of concerns. But in terms of like the legal analysis, it doesn't actually factor in.
And I think part of it, too, we're being asked right now whether the National District Attorneys Association wants to support Project Hope out of Hawaii. It's Judge Alm. Judge Alm has done amazing things. He calls it intensive supervision. He takes the worst of the worst. He brings them in. Look me in the eye. If you violate, I will lock you up. You have the key to the prison in your pocket. They have to report. They have very serious, what really parole is supposed to be. Recidivism has gone down 50%. Drug use among them has gone down 65%. It is a very effective program. But Peter Carlisle, the district attorney of Honolulu, will tell you that there's about 5 dead people. And dead's dead. And so do you, and these are people that would have been otherwise locked up had they not been in Project Hope. So we're talking about, you know, reducing crime or weighing the benefits. Is 5 dead people worth a 65% reduction in positive drug tests and a 50% reduction in recidivism? And the answer to that, I think, would be, are you related to, or did you know, or were you associated with the victims?
We have time for one last question. Yes.
I have a question. Other than the consideration that what the victims have to go through every time someone comes up for parole, is there another reason other than that to deny teenagers or children or whatever you want to call them a parole hearing later down the road? Do we not have like faith that the people that you stay in will stay in and the people that might have an opportunity to come out should come out?
Well, one of the things that people don't like to talk about, but Rachel knows this because she practiced in Southern California where I did. I'm sorry. Mary, God. I know a Rachel fan. I was just dealing with her. I really apologize. Professor fan. Is punishment. One of the features of the criminal justice system is to exact retribution for crimes committed. And there is a need for closure in cases. There is a doctrine in constitutional law, essentially, that says something's got to come to an end at some point. And so that does not technically apply to post-appellate matters like parole. But I think when you would talk to public policymakers in the states, and by the way, if you look at all the states that pass these laws, more Democrats voted for these laws than Republicans in the 44 states. Just a historical anomaly. And I think they feel that there needs to be punishment for the ultimate crimes.
I mean, I think the thing with the states passing the laws, the one concern, I mean, a number of concerns about this issue, about the states wanting this or wanting these practices, is that, you know, no state has set the age as low as 13. In Florida, the law would allow for a child as young as 5 or 6 years old to be sentenced to life without parole. And the other issue is that, you know, earlier we were talking about how rarely meted out these sentences are. And actual practice should really inform where the states are with this. In all of these states that have this practice, there are 6, 4, we just said? For
11 don't use or prohibited.
Right. So the actual practice is really what we should be looking at, not just the fact that the laws are on the books. And like I said, the laws that were on the books are actually a confluence of a number of different laws, not actually aimed at sending kids to jail, but giving prosecutors and judges more authority to try kids in the adult system, and ratcheting up penalties for adult crimes, for adults, not for kids.
Thank you very much. We give our panelists a round of applause.
Thank you, everyone, for coming, and Professor Fan again for moderating, and thank you all for being here. We are going to have a reception in the JD Student Lounge. There's lots of food there, so please come even just for a minute to pull a plate. Get some food, mingle a little bit. Hopefully a couple of our panelists can stay around for at least a few minutes to talk and answer maybe some more of your questions. But thanks again for coming.